This lecture was organized by the Jewish Museum and Kreskas and the Levison Institute, for which I'm very grateful, because in this way we can reach more people. It was also organized in collaboration with the University of Amsterdam, and I'm happy to see Marco Passi in our midst. Actually, the lecture is not by me, and it is by Moshe Idel, and I would like him to come to the front and announce himself a bit more than I do. He is a distinguished professor at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, came here for a conference on Kabbalah, and will lecture about 17th century Kabbalah in Amsterdam. Let me help you to arrange this. Yeah? What if I mean? Between
you. Okay. Good morning. I'm glad to be here and to have the opportunity to be at the conference and see a little bit Amsterdam. In 45 minutes, I shall try to do the impossible. I want to give an introduction to Judaism, an introduction to Kabbalah, and then to speak about Kabbalah in Amsterdam. I hope it can be done in 45 minutes. So, 3 minutes introduction to Judaism. If we divide the history of Judaism in 3 millennia, one before Common Era, the second after the Common Era, and more recently, the last millennium, we have 3 major books which became canonical. One is the Bible. The other one is Talmud or Talmudic literature. And the third one is the Book of the Zohar, which is the Kabbalistic canon. The Bible deals only with one single issue, and that is what happened and what to do. What, if you remember. What happened in history and what should people do, the commandments. In the second millennium, in the Talmudic literature, there's also only one issue. How to do. How to do the commandments of the Talmud. And how what is told in the Bible happened really, because we don't know a lot of details about the stories in the Bible. The Bible is very concise, so we have the Midrash telling you that really the elliptic part of the stories can be filled, and so we know how it happened. So we finished the second millennium. The third millennium deals also only with one issue, and that is why. Why is not a question in the Bible. The why is obvious, because God decided that it should be so. So that's not a very important issue to describe exactly the intentions of God, because God's intentions are His business. He's only externalizing His will, and we must obey. The why doesn't appear also in the Talmudic literature. You must know how to do, not why to do. So, for the last millennium, we have a lot of books dealing with why. We can distinguish between 2 major literatures dealing with this why. One is Jewish philosophy, which didn't exist before, with the exception of Philo of Alexandria. You may forget him. It was not important for the history of Judaism, but very important for the history of Christianity. So we have Jewish philosophy, attempting to describe God, describe the commandments, what is the real meaning of commandments. And then we have the Kabbalistic literature, dealing a lot with why. So that's my history of Judaism in 5 minutes. Now we shall move to the history of Kabbalah. So, Kabbalah emerged, at least historically speaking, since late 12th century in southern France and later in Spain. Like philosophy, like magic, like literature, Kabbalah doesn't have an intrinsic structure. There are many, many schools different from each other. From time to time, in very great tension between one school and another, sometimes I'm ignoring the other. So it would be futile to give you a description of Kabbalah. I can tell you, if you like, that the esoteric aspect of Judaism, but that's also philosophy. And whatever nice definition you're going to bring me, I can easily deconstruct it in 1 minute. So I'm not going to describe what Kabbalah is or was, because it was many, many different things. I shall try to give you, at least in this specific context, two main lines. One line can be described as the mythical Kabbalah, which means the main line, which appeared in Provence and then in Spain and then in Safed, and I'm going to describe that more in a moment, which was not very philosophical, was interested much more in describing the inner life of the deity, of God, the Ten Sefirot, and the interaction, that's very important, between what we do here, the commandments, and the structure of the divine world. What is the mythical element here? God is not a simple unity, that if you like, if you prefer to call it monotheism, that's a dynamic monotheism, which depends much, and that's very important, on what we do here below. When God is interacting long before the modern era, interaction was very, very important. God is not existing in a static perfection in himself, herself, but his structure is changing all the time in accordance to what we do. That is why what we do has a meaning, and that's the why we do it. We do something in order to have an impact on the divinity. So I believe that I summarized basically the book of the Zohar. Not everything in this book, but I believe the quintessence of the book. This line, the mythical line, was developed in a dramatic manner, as I mentioned, in late 13th century Spain, and then in Safed, in the second half of the 16th century. So the two main phases of the mythical Kabbalah is Spain and then Safed. In this line, philosophical issues are marginal. They exist, but they are marginal. From time to time, they are strongly criticized, even described as totally negative, and in some instances as the venom. And that's the alien impact, which destroyed, to a certain extent, according to the Kabbalist, the Jewish life by introducing Greek philosophy. The second line, which is secondary, can be called the more philosophical-oriented Kabbalah. It existed also at the beginning, and to a certain extent in Spain, but it was always secondary in Spain. But it developed in a dramatic manner in Italy since late 13th century, and even more since the Florentine Renaissance, late 15th century. It became more and more powerful in places in which philosophy was flowering in non-Jewish environment. This Kabbalah represents an interpretation of the mythical Kabbalah, meaning an attempt to give a philosophical meaning, not a mythical meaning, to Jewish life, which means the introduction in the Kabbalistic discourse of a variety of philosophical trends of thinking. In fact, almost whatever you can imagine. Mostly Aristotle. A lot Plato and Neoplatonism. Hermetic traditions. Pythagorean philosophy. And I doubt if someone can mention one form of philosophy which was in existence before, which cannot be traced in one Kabbalistic book or another. What is the meaning of this introduction of philosophical concepts in the Kabbalistic discourse? Is the attenuation of mythology and the creation of an intellectual, mentalistic understanding of Kabbalah. Kabbalah is conceived to be much more a matter of a general description of the cosmos, of entire reality, of man, an anthropology which is strongly philosophical, and also God is described from time to time as similar to what we can find in basically Neoplatonic thinking. That is what's going on in Italy since late 13th century, accelerated at the end of the 15th century in Florence, and accelerated again at the end of the 16th century in northern Italy, not only in Florence. So, let me move now to some processes which will culminate in Amsterdam. In the second half of the 16th century, two major figures, major Kabbalists, emerged in Safed. One is called Moses Cordovero, a little bit closer to the philosophical Kabbalah, but still strongly mythical, and someone who is more famous, Rabbi Isaac Luria Hari, who disclosed some Kabbalistic secrets between 1570-1572. In 2 years, Luria created a revolution in Kabbalah before he died suddenly. The Kabbalah of Luria is highly mythological, rejecting openly any philosophical concept. And this Kabbalah was destined to become one of the most powerful forms of thinking in Judaism in 17th and 18th century. As I mentioned, Luria didn't like philosophy and he didn't want to disseminate his Kabbalah at all. He wanted to have his Kabbalah to remain in a very small circle of students, no more than 10, and people had to sign in order to come to his seminar, and only 10 could come, that they are not going to disclose the secrets even to other Kabbalists in Safed. So that is part of what can be called a particularistic form of Kabbalah. And if you ask me why was this Luria afraid that his Kabbalah will be known outside, meaning in Safed, he had very good reasons, because he was quite sure that immediately, by internet, his Kabbalah is going to arrive to Italy. How did he know? Because around him there were a lot of Italian Jews who came to study Kabbalah in the great center of advanced studies named Safed. And those Italian Jews were immediately copying whatever happened in Safed and sending to Italy. What is so bad to send to Italy? It is bad because the Italians are going to interpret his Kabbalah philosophically. And he didn't want to have it also Christologically. So he decided that no more than 10 Kabbalists, who are very faithful, will attend his lectures. Didn't help him too much in his lifetime, which means less than a year or a year and a half, that's the period he was in Safed. His teaching arrived to Italy. He died young in 1572, and for many decades his students, most of his students, kept his Kabbalah secret. And his most important student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, himself a Kabbalist, whose family coming from Italy, he was called Calabrese, kept the teachings of Luria secret, and only when he was ill, his brother gave for money access to some Kabbalists to copy manuscripts. But as I mentioned, it didn't help. Some of the manuscript transpired to Italy, and what's more important, one of the students of Luria, named Israel Saruk, made his way from Safed to northern Italy and taught a version of Lurianic Kabbalah openly to the public in Italy. So, as we know from a variety of documents, we have manuscripts, but what's important for my point here is the fact that his most important student, Rabbi Abraham Cohen Herrera, a Kabbalist who came from an Amarano background, studied with him either in Yugoslavia or for a part of time in Italy, studied Lurianic Kabbalah with him. And this Abraham Cohen Herrera, coming from a Amarano background, was well acquainted with general philosophy. Well acquainted, meaning he was in fact a certain form of Italian intellectual who knew Piccola Mirandola and Marsilio Ficino and a variety of medieval scholastic philosophy and 16th century Renaissance philosophy. He maybe knew better Italian or Spanish than Hebrew. And after a variety of adventures, he was in North Africa and then in London, and he landed in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, he wrote two Kabbalistic books. He wrote three books, but two of them Kabbalistic, for the first time, to our best knowledge, in Spanish. Kabbalah, you may know, was written always either in Hebrew or in Aramaic, with very few exceptions in Arabic, very few exceptions, never in any other language, but much later, Yiddish. What is outstanding is that for the first time we have two full-fledged Kabbalistic books written in Spanish. You can imagine why, because the public here knew Spanish better than Hebrew. But that's much more than a problem of language. His form of Kabbalah represents, in fact, a continuation of what happened to Kabbalah in Italy, in Amsterdam. And this point I would like to emphasize very much because it seems to me important. Italy is a form of spatial type of Jewish culture, not only in the Renaissance, but much earlier. It is found, as you may know, between East and West of Jewish literature, and between North and South. Everything varied with it. Whatever happened in Ashkenaz, in Spain, in Northern Africa, everything arrived to Italy. Italy had a spatial place, but given the relative openness of Italian culture and the flowering of philosophy in Italy, Kabbalah received the spatial philosophical nuances of labor in Italy. So it happened long before Herrera. However, Herrera brought this development of the philosophical Kabbalah to the peak. I mean, no philosopher before knew so well medieval and Renaissance philosophy. No Kabbalist before dared to offer such a strong amalgam or synthesis or combination, however you like to put it, or misinterpretation or interpretation of Kabbalah as erratic. Meaning, he was a professional philosopher from this point of view. The third book that he wrote is a book on logic, and he could write a book on logic, which is unlogical for any Kabbalist to do. So he did it, and that's only, if you like, as a symbol of his philosophical education. So what happened in the writings written in the 30s of the 17th century, in what we call here the Golden Age, in the Spanish books of Herrera, which are found in Etz Chaim library, the manuscripts, and are still unprinted in their original. I can speak a little bit about translations. So what's going on there? Is, in fact, a very strong interpretation of Lurianic Kabbalah, the most mythical Kabbalah in Judaism, in the most philosophical way possible. And here we have the nightmares of Luria. He was afraid it's going to happen, and suffered the nightmare materialized in Amsterdam. I'd like to call it a nightmare. For Luria, it was a nightmare. For general philosophy, that's a totally different story, as I should try to show. But for Luria, that was something that represents the deepest misunderstanding of his thinking, and I shall try to explain why, and so tell you what happened here in Amsterdam from this point of view. For Luria, history and creation is a drama full of raptures. The most important rapture is the fact that God couldn't easily create the world. He has to retreat from a certain place in order to create, and there we have the idea of Tzimtzum, the divine withdrawal, which is a drama. And then, when he started to create the world, a certain breaking of vessels, of divine powers took place. That is raptures, strong raptures. And his vision of the world was dramatically negative. The world was considered to be a big exile, and the Kabbalists were supposed all the time to work in order to redeem the divine sparks which fell from this breaking of the vessels in our world. So the entire project of Luria is predicated on this idea of rapture, divine failure, and the need of man to labor all the time in order to repair. Repair what? God's failure, our failures. I cannot enter into detail. That is mythical by any standards in comparative religion. If someone insists, he can find a philosophy there. But that's a philosophy only as in a very vague form. He himself never conceived his Kabbalah as a philosophy, but I would say the center of this Kabbalah, of Lurianic Kabbalah, or the original form of Lurianic Kabbalah, is the idea of how to teach the Kabbalist to live his ritual life in the best way, which means by the commandments, someone is rescuing the sparks of God and returns them to their original place. Nothing similar is known, to my best knowledge, in any form of philosophy, in which continuity or stasis or perfection is much more important than rupture and failure of the divine. All those elements were removed by Avraham Herrera. He came with a structure which emphasized very strongly the continuity of the process of emanation. In the way he studied it, basically in the writings of Marsilio Ficino. And he came up with the idea, which is for sure not new in him, I shall speak about this later, that in fact what he is doing to introduce philosophy in Luria is nothing new, because Luria and in principle the Bible have the entire philosophical structure there in the original. He didn't believe that he is creating a new interpretation, for sure not a misinterpretation. He was sure, following many other Kabbalists, Christian and Jewish, that by using philosophy someone is discovering a hidden truth there. And he is repeating all the time that in fact he's mentioning Ficino and Pico and Thomas d'Aquinas and many others doesn't mean that he is changing the nature of Kabbalah, but on the contrary, he's illuminating Kabbalah and retrieving the hidden truths of Kabbalah by using philosophical tools. This is for sure a dramatic development, and this line is continued by the other important figure in Amsterdam, Menashe ben Israel, a little bit younger, under the impact of Avraham Herrera. Menashe ben Israel also came up with this idea that in fact Kabbalah has a lot of philosophical truths and we must use philosophy in order to make sense of Kabbalah. That is found in more than one of Menashe ben Israel's writings, in which he is making it plain that in fact Pythagoras took everything from Judaism and Plato did it, and actually everything interesting is already found in Kabbalah, which is very, very ancient, and everyone took philosophy from Kabbalah. So without being such a great Kabbalist as Avraham Herrera, Menashe ben Israel continued his Herrera's line. However, he did something more. Thank you. From time to time, Menashe ben Israel is copying philosophical text, purely philosophical text, and saying, ah, that's Kabbalah. For example, he's copying from the writings of Yitzhak Abarbanel and his son, Yehuda Abarbanel, Leon Ebrel, copying from them and saying, that's Kabbalah. And for him, even philosophy, as it is, can be conceived to be Kabbalah. Meaning, philosophy is not only an interpretation of Kabbalah. Philosophy, Neoplatonic philosophy, basically, can be quoted as Kabbalah. So that is an exaggeration of what is found already in Avraham Herrera and in other Kabbalists. Why Menashe ben Israel did something like that, there is more than one answer. One of them is simply some of the philosophical texts he's quoting were printed by mistake together with Kabbalistic writings at the end of the 16th century by a certain Christian Kabbalist named Pistorius, and it's written Ars Kabbalistica, so everything there must be Kabbalistic, and I told you he was not a great Kabbalist. So he copied from there. Another explanation, which I hope doesn't contradict this explanation, is that he was married with a lady from the Abarbanel family, Rachel Abarbanel, and he wanted also Yitzhak Abarbanel and Yehuda Abarbanel to be Kabbalists, because that's Amvok. So why shouldn't they be Kabbalists? So maybe the two explanations are corroborating each other. In any case, we have, in fact, in Amsterdam, two major figures who exaggerated this philosophical interpretation of Kabbalah beyond whatever you can find in Italy or elsewhere ever. What is going on in this enterprise is a common theory found in the Middle Ages, as I mentioned, that everything is found in the Torah, that you may know from many other sources. So this idea that everything valid, must be found in the Torah, is explicated now in a new way by using Neoplatonic philosophy. And given the fact that Kabbalah is the essence of the Torah. Also, the philosophical implications are found in Kabbalah and in the Torah. This vision of the all-inclusive nature of ancient Jewish law and Kabbalah was conceived to be an ancient form of Judaism, received its strongest blow in Amsterdam by another figure named Spinoza. We can look to Spinoza also from this perspective, meaning the Torah doesn't have any philosophical meaning. It's a book of law. And all the attempts made by Maimonides, for him the problem was Maimonides, not the Kabbalists, but I hope to return to Kabbalah in a moment. For him, the attempts made by Maimonides to say that philosophy is found in the Torah is a huge misunderstanding, and his enterprise and his theological political treatise is to show that in fact law is law and philosophy is philosophy, and the two should be combined. I don't say that he was irritated by Avraham Herrera and Menashe Ben Israel, but on the other side, it's impossible to assume that he was not acquainted with this strong attempt, much stronger than Maimonides, to put together philosophy with Jewish religion. And I would say to a certain extent, he reacted to the exaggeration, which is not parallel to anything else in Jewish tradition beforehand. However, even Spinoza was not totally free of Kabbalah. And I hope now to summarize my lecture by attempting to convince you that strong as he was against Kabbalah, and I have no doubt he was against Kabbalah, he didn't escape Kabbalah. He didn't know that he is a Kabbalist despite the fact that he opposed Kabbalah. Let's take two of the most important dicta of Spinoza. One of them is Deus sive natura, God or nature. So that's very important for Spinoza, that's summarizing to a great extent his philosophy. And there are many, many attempts to find out what is the source of this formula. The most important attempt was done by a major historian of philosophy, Harry Wollstone, who dedicated to it long pages in order to find out where it's found. So I can tell you where it's found. It's found in Kabbalah. So I shall try to explain you in 2 minutes. One, in Kabbalah there is a gematria, which in Hebrew sounds as follows: Elohim ze hateva. That's exactly Spinoza. What does it mean in Hebrew? That a certain facet or dimension of the divinity, called Elohim, amounts in gematria, like the term Teva, both of them 91. It's not just a gematria. That's a gematria which appears at least 20 times in the history of Kabbalah. And that is the result of the impact of Maimonides. I cannot enter how now to explain you how. And this gematria was known in Kabbalistic writings, printed in at least since 1575 in Germany and Hanau. Until someone will show me something closer, I believe that this gematria had an impact on Spinoza. For sure, Spinoza was a first-rank philosopher who was able to take this identification to an analytical discourse which has no parallel in Kabbalah. But for the time being, I believe that Kabbalah supplied a trigger for the elaboration of Spinoza. Let's take the second important Spinozistic expression, Amor Dei Intellectualis, which means we love God by an intellectual love. Again, there's a lot of scholarship about it. To my best knowledge, no one came closer to an expression found in Kabbalah, Ava Eloi Tzichit, found, you won't believe, in the same book in which Elohim, Zehateva, is found also. Now, that doesn't mean for sure that Spinoza was a Kabbalist. I believe that we have here in the two dicta and more some form of triggers which actually gave an initial starting point to Spinoza, and he developed his philosophy divorced from Kabbalah, with no doubt. However, the two dicta mentioned earlier are part of the philosophical Kabbalah, and not for the mythical one, which Spinoza disliked and even criticized in one of his letters. So, in order to summarize my lecture, we can say the following. We have in Amsterdam, in the 30s and the 40s of the 17th century, a unique development which continues the Italian Renaissance by combining Kabbalah and philosophy and creating the most philosophical interpretation of Kabbalah. On the other side, we have the strongest opposition to this tendency of introducing whatever philosophical truths in classical Jewish text, a tendency represented by Spinoza. Now, Spinoza maybe was acquainted with Abraham Herrera. However, there's no doubt that Abraham Herrera had a very illustrious history in the history of philosophy, given the fact that his book, written in Spanish, was translated in Latin and studied by interesting philosophers like Leibniz, who apparently was influenced by the philosophical interpretation of Kabbalah of Abraham Herrera. At least we have some notes wrote by Leibniz himself, describing what he was interested when he studied Kabbalah. And we can find traces of Herrera in the big critics against Spinoza, and some people who criticized Spinoza made him very, very Kabbalistic. And they used Abraham Herrera to show, look, you see that he is a Kabbalist. So we can look to the history of Kabbalah from the point of view of Amsterdam as a moment of the peak. Since then, since 1645, this philosophical interpretation of Kabbalah declined, the mythical Kabbalah became much stronger, Sabbatianism became the most prevalent form of Kabbalah. It arrived, as you may know, also to Amsterdam, and the glories of the philosophical Kabbalah dissipated immediately and didn't return to Amsterdam or elsewhere. Thank you very much.